Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Does the cost of flood insurance in Delaware match the risk? And is everyone paying what they should?
Obviously, if the government is not charging enough for flood insurance, someone's paying for it, and that's the taxpayers.
Our Sophia Schmidt takes a look at flood insurance in two very different places in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn what the first set of medical residents coming to Bay Health means for healthcare in Delaware. And we examine another historic preservation battle, this time in Wilmington. Plus, Arts Playlist has more on a unique film acquisition by Hagley Museum. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Flood risk is increasing due to climate change across the country and in low-lying coastal Delaware. But flood insurance rates aren't high enough to cover the growing risk, or even the risk right now. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt digs into new research that illuminates who might be paying too much, or too little, for flood insurance in the first state. And takes us to two very different communities to see how higher flood insurance rates might affect residents.
That's the sound of concrete being poured for the pilings that will raise a brand new house off the ground and hopefully out of the reach of future floodwaters. The house is right off Cedar Street, which is sandwiched between the Delaware Bay and the Lewis and Rehoboth Canal along Lewis Beach. Cedar Street is known to flood when water from the canal spills over embankments. The whole street is in the Federal Emergency Management Agency's high-risk flood zone, and the agency projects a 1 in 100-year flood there would reach an elevation of 8 feet. But a resident named Richard, who owns the flood-prone lot and is paying to build the new house on it, is not worried.
Because you'd have to go up, we would have to have a 12-foot tide surge to have flooding get into the living area.
The living area is elevated thanks to requirements of FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program and of the city of Lewis. Cedar Street is a patchwork of small, older cottages that were built flat on the ground before the elevation requirements, and newer, bigger houses built up on tall foundations or with garages underneath. When Richard bought his property as a second home 8 years ago, it was one of the small ones. Now that he's moved to Lewis full-time, he's replacing it with something bigger. He did look into the cost of flood insurance before buying, but says for now, it's not a financial burden.
But I'm retired also, so who knows what's going to happen in the future.
Flood insurance premiums could increase in many places under a new risk-based flood insurance pricing scheme FEMA plans to implement this year. The National Flood Insurance Program is $36 billion in debt because it pays out more in claims than it collects in premiums. Through the program, taxpayers subsidize risky development. If all homes with substantial flood risk were to insure through the National Flood Insurance Program, rates would need to more than quadruple to cover current risk. That's according to a recent analysis by First Street Foundation, a nonprofit research group that studies flood risk. The group used a probabilistic flood model that accounts for climate change and found that current flood insurance rates would need to increase more than 7 times to cover the growing risk by 2051.
In Delaware in particular, we see that there's a bigger disparity in terms of economic damage for properties that do experience structural damage from flooding events relative to their NFIP policies.
Jeremy Porter is head of research and development at First Street Foundation. His team found that out of any state, Delaware has the largest gap between the economic damage from flooding that researchers expect from their risk model and the average flood insurance premiums.
Really, that's driven by a couple of things. One is the fact that the places that are likely to be impacted by flooding in Delaware tend to be places with high property values and really high probability flooding. So places like Lewis, Delaware, which has, you know, 2 year, 5 year, pretty high probability flooding depths, but also has an average property value over $1 million.
In Delaware, Lewis is one of the municipalities with the biggest difference between First Street's average expected loss each year on flood-prone properties and the average premium they pay through the National Flood Insurance Program. That's $2,500 a year for insurance compared to $38,000 in modeled loss. Lewis is also one of 11 municipalities and counties in Delaware where residents get a discount on flood insurance because of actions the local government took to reduce or plan for flood risk.
See, as you can see, I mean, this is the marsh area. I mean, you're already, we have water laying here in the marsh. That's somewhat due probably because of the high tide and also the way the wind's blowing.
It's a sunny day in Lewis, and city building manager Robin Davis stands on the side of the main road describing a large plot of land that's been left intentionally undeveloped to reduce flooding.
What else? It helps. It really does. I mean, again, with if that was road surface or concrete, the water was going other way, would have to go somewhere else. This way, at least it does have a chance to recede back in the ground.
Preserving open space earned the city of Lewis points in FEMA's community rating system, which incentivizes local governments to take steps to mitigate or prepare for floods and rewards them with discounts on residents' flood insurance. Lewis residents currently get 5% off their premiums, which is the program's smallest discount. But residents in FEMA's special flood hazard areas will get 10% discounts starting April 1st. The upgrade is a result of actions the city took in recent years, including outreach and education into building policy known as Freeboard, which adds an 18-inch vertical buffer to FEMA's elevation requirements.
It's a safety factor.
Lewis doesn't seem to be seeing the damage the First Street Foundation estimates. State environmental officials have questioned First Street Foundation's loss estimates as overblown. They are much higher than historic yearly flood insurance claims. In fact, Robin, Lewis's building manager, says there's been minimal property damage from flooding in the 7 years he's worked for the city.
And it's more streets flooding. There are some homes. Again, we don't get that massive 120, 130 mile an hour winds and the storm surge that comes with the hurricanes, or we haven't, which is very fortunate.
But that could change.
I think, you know, everybody talks about sea level rise and the climate changes and things like that. And again, there has been a record of showing that these storms are getting more intense and more frequent. So us being fortunate that right now we've been on the lower end of the scale of being hit with a major storm, that chance is always greater, I think, in now and in the future.
Intermediate sea level rise scenarios put the yard and side street that Richard's new house is being built on underwater before the end of the century. The way flood insurance is currently priced, it's not deterring construction in the floodplain.
People are still building. People are buying the older homes that are on Lewis Beach and demolishing them and turning them into newer homes.
Not everyone in Delaware is getting as good a deal on flood insurance as the residents of Lewis. An NPR analysis of First Street Foundation and U.S. Census Bureau data found that nationwide and in Delaware, the people who are getting the best deals on flood insurance live in communities that are whiter and whose median household income is higher. According to First Street Foundation, the average flood insurance premium in Lewis only covers about 7% of the current average annual loss they estimate on properties with flood risk. But in most of the city of Wilmington, including flood-prone Southbridge, First Street's data shows average flood insurance premiums are more appropriately priced to cover flood damage. In fact, residents appear to be slightly overpaying. Southbridge is situated in the bend of a tidal river. The neighborhood's low elevation and poor drainage have meant decades of periodic flooding. Siobhan White had only lived on Bradford Street a few years when she had her first real experience with it. It was a rainy evening in 2012. It seemed like just a normal rain, nothing big.
Went to bed and I was waking about 6 o'clock in the morning. Someone was banging on my door and I went down. It was my neighbor. And I looked out, and it was just like the sea, almost how I could describe it. The water was up to the door handles on all of our cars.
Siobhan's car was totaled, but the floodwaters didn't reach her house since it's built up higher than the street. She does have flood insurance because it's required for houses like hers in FEMA's high-risk zone with a federally backed mortgage.
I was a little surprised because I wasn't told that by my realtor at the time. So I was like, fine. So when I got the quote, I was shocked.
She learned it would be over $1,200 a year. She was able to get her premium reduced by more than half by producing the house's original elevation certificate. But even so,
you know, home ownership is very important. I was young mother at the time, so it was very important to me. And it was a situation where I could afford it. But just because you can afford something doesn't mean you want to have to pay, you know.
Wilmington residents do not get the community rating system discount that residents of Delaware beach towns and even Newcastle County enjoy. The mayor's office says the city looked into joining the program several years ago, but didn't have enough points to qualify. Since then, the city has started a $28 million wetland park and sewer separation project meant to reduce flooding in Southbridge. And the city has enacted an 18-inch freeboard policy, just like Lewis. The mayor's office indicated it may now revisit Wilmington's eligibility. The community rating system discount likely accounts for a little of the difference in flood insurance deals that First Street Foundation found residents of Lewis and Wilmington are getting. Experts say it's probably due, at least in part, to the fact that flood insurance premiums don't take into account how expensive a house is. So the same flood in Southbridge and Lewis would cause pricier damage to the bigger homes in the beach town. But community rating system discounts could help residents afford flood insurance and offset the higher rates that are expected in the future. Siobhan found out about the program back when she bought her house in 2009.
I labored over that FEMA website for days and hours and seemed like months. And when I came across it, I was surprised that Wilmington wasn't on it.
She says she reached out to local elected officials about the community rating system, but never heard back. FEMA plans to implement its new insurance pricing scheme called Risk Rating 2.0 in October. Risk-based price signals should give homeowners a clearer understanding of their true flood risk. But the Congressional Research Service has noted Risk Rating 2.0 could lead to premium increases for some policyholders that make flood insurance unaffordable. According to NPR, changes proposed under Risk Rating 2.0, like factoring home value into pricing, could narrow some of the race and income disparities they identified. But Southbridge still faces increasing risk from climate change. Like parts of Lewis, Siobhan's street and several others in her neighborhood are expected to be underwater by the end of the century. If insurance rates rise in Southbridge, it could hurt the neighborhood's low-income residents. Siobhan works for the state, where she leads the Office of Supplier Diversity. She says even if her flood insurance premiums go up, she doesn't expect to be priced out.
My worry is more about other residents who are here in Southbridge, who are on fixed incomes, and they would be priced out. And also, you know, someone who was in my situation at the time, wanting to become a first-time homeowner, looking for something that they could afford, and then being priced out because of flood insurance. So that's going to deter. I mean, if you look in the Southbridge neighborhood, it's predominantly a Black neighborhood. And so that's going to deter other Black people from, you know, owning a home, you know, getting some type of wealth for their family.
For his part, Richard, the retiree building a house in Lewis's floodplain, thinks flood insurance premiums should accurately reflect risk.
Well, obviously, if the government is not charging enough for flood insurance, someone's paying for it, and that's the taxpayers. We're subsidizing the fact that, you know, if someone wants to build a house, $1 million house on a sandbar in the middle of a hurricane zone, it's pretty likely that it's going to get wiped out every once in a while. And from that standpoint, you should pay the fair amount of insurance. It's just that it's always been subsidized because they never have. So if they change it now, that would be, is what it is.
But striking the right balance between cost and risk is not easy. FEMA has struggled to keep flood insurance affordable and the flood insurance program on solid financial ground. That balance will only get trickier as the impacts of climate change mount. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. Next on The Green, Bay Health is welcoming the first residents to its new medical residency program. And we look at what this could mean for healthcare in central and southern Delaware. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Bay Health recently announced the inaugural class of the health system's new medical residency program. The program's goal is to add more physicians in southern and central Delaware, where there's a dearth of primary care physicians for a growing and aging population. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino recently spoke with Bay Health's Internal Medicine Residency Program Director, Dr. Joseph Deutsch, about the program and its mission to improve access to care in the first state.
Bay Health's residency program has been a couple years in the making. What's it been like for you to see this project get off the ground?
So I joined the organization in a full-time capacity about a year ago. I was interviewed for the position about a year before that, and I was really intrigued by the idea. I am a native Delawarean. I grew up in Wilmington. I have been working in the Wilmington-Newark area at Christiana Care, and when I learned that Bay Health was going to be starting a brand new residency program, it immediately piqued my interest. When you're an educator, the opportunity to start something from scratch and start something that is in your home state and make an impact on your home state, I just was immediately drawn to that. So I came down, met who would become my boss, Dr. Gary Siegelman, met Dr. Asar Rather, who really was the visionary for starting graduate medical education at Bay Health, and just was really impressed what they had already put into place and what they were asking me to do to start the internal medicine program here. It's been a fun journey since I've been here for about the past year now, all culminating in our match day last Friday, where we were able to find out who our first group of medical residents will be this coming July.
Yes, tell me more about match day. What is that?
So match day is a very interesting phenomenon. So medical students, when they're graduating from medical school, need to more or less find their first job. And that first job is what we call residency. They are going to become physicians, but they are going to be physicians still in training. So they require supervision. And depending on what they are training to become, they go into a residency program that is at a minimum 3 years long. So for internal medicine and family medicine, which is the two residency programs that Bay Health is starting with here in July, both of our programs are 3 years long. So medical students from around the country look and decide which residency program would I like to be at next year. They submit applications. This was our first year as a brand new program. We received over 2,000 applications for internal medicine and over 2,000 applications for family medicine. This is for 8 positions in family medicine and 13 positions in internal medicine. So this is a process where, you know, you are literally looking at hundreds of people for each one of your spots. What does this look like from the medical student's perspective? They apply to programs they want to be at. They will get invited to interview at programs that are interested in them. When they complete that process, they rank the programs that they met with from 1 to however many they want to rank in the order that they'd prefer to be there. And we do the same. We ended up interviewing for internal medicine about 250 people, for family medicine about 150 people. And then we go ahead and rank those two groups as well, you know, from who we want most to who we think was the least qualified on our list, but still someone we would want to be here. Because how the match day works is a computer then determines where each person, medical student around the country, will end up. And that decision by that computer is legally binding. So when you find out as a medical student that I'm coming to Bay Health, that is a decision. You're going to be with us for the next 3 years. So what medical students, as you would imagine, do is they rank only programs they really want to be at. We only rank medical students we really want to have be part of a program. And then we find out where everybody's going to end up. Both of our programs were really excited about the people who matched with us this first year. We were both looking at medical students who had a connection to this area, people who we thought would want to practice in this area for years to come, because our whole team here is well aware of the physician shortage in central and southern Delaware. And we really wanted residents who would decide after 3 years of training, hey, I want to join a practice or start a practice of my own and spend my career here taking care of patients in this community.
Now, as you said, the program started with family medicine and internal medicine, a total of 25 residents. Are those two programs going to expand in the future? And then what's it going to look like as Bay Health expands its overall residency program?
So, Nick, it's actually just it's 21 residents that we have this year. So 13 residents with internal medicine and then 8 residents with family medicine. So how our two programs will grow is that it's a 3-year program. So each of us will be recruiting 13 more and 8 more next year, and then 13 more and 8 more the following year. So when fully staffed, the internal medicine residency program will be 39 residents. The family medicine program will be 24 residents. We are starting 2 other what we call categorical residency programs. One of them is in general surgery. That program will be recruiting its first group of residents in 2021 to 2022 with a start date of July of 2022. They will be recruiting 3 residents for their first class. General surgery is a 5-year residency program. So then when they are fully staffed, they will have 15 residents. We are also going to be starting an emergency medicine residency program. Its start date is still a little ways off. Their first residents will be starting in July of 2023. My understanding is they're recruiting 5 residents per year. They also are a 3-year residency program like family medicine and internal medicine, so they will eventually have 15 residents. We are looking at a 1-year program as well, what's called a transitional year program. This is a program that's actually a bridge to other residency programs. It's a time for a resident to gain sort of general medicine knowledge before going into a subspecialty such as radiology or dermatology. This program, we're expected to actually have somewhere between 10 and 15 residents per year, but this is just a 1-year program. So we'll only have those 10 or 15 in addition. Ultimately, Bay Health as an organization is planning on having just over 100 residents per year when this program is fully built out, which we expect to be in about 5 years' time.
You mentioned earlier the shortage of physicians in central and southern Delaware. Can you speak to how this program seeks to deal with that issue?
Absolutely. So the first way it's going to deal with it is that residents are doctors. So they, when they get here in July, they will be seeing patients in our community, whether it be here in the hospital at the Kent campus or Sussex campus, but as well as family medicine residency program, as well as internal medicine residency program, are both opening brand new outpatient practices. The family medicine program office will be located in Dover. The internal medicine residency program office will be located in Milford. And when these two offices, again, are fully staffed with residents and faculty, which will be in a few years' time, we expect that they are going to be adding, in combination, 50,000 new outpatient visits to this community per year. Even this first year, when, of course, we are not fully staffed yet, we just have our first year of residents, between the two campuses, I expect we're going to be adding about 10,000 new outpatient visits just this year. So these are visits that if you're a person who lives in our community, have been trying to find a new doctor and can't, either you call and the doctor's office is not accepting new patients, or when you call they are, but maybe can't see you for several months, we think access to our two offices will be much better than that. So, you know, right away, we're going to be able to help this community from day one in July. The longer term, I think our impact is going to be even greater. We know from experience and from data that many residents, generally up to 50% of residents who train in the area, stay in that area after they graduate. So, you know, we can anticipate that, you know, several of our residents, if not 50% or maybe even greater because of the people we've recruited to the program, will be practicing here after residency is completed. So these are people who are going to become primary care physicians. They're going to become subspecialists like cardiologists, pulmonologists, endocrinologists. So really people who can take care of a full range of medical issues that patients in our community encounter. And as our community grows, it's also getting older, you know, and of course, as we age, you know, our necessity for a primary care physician only increases. And our physicians are getting older. You know, physicians who have been in this community for 20, 30 years are nearing retirement age. So we really need an influx of young physicians. And this residency the graduate medical education program, you know, through residency training, it is going to do that right away. And that ripple and that effect is really going to be felt, you know, we anticipate, you know, for decades into the future.
Thanks to BayHealth's Internal Medicine Residency Program Director, Dr. Joseph Deutsch, and our Nick Schellino for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at the latest historic preservation battle in the First State in Willington's Browntown neighborhood. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The fate of another historic property is up in the air, this time in Wilmington's Browntown neighborhood. Residents and preservation advocates are fighting an effort to demolish the Brown House, which dates back to around 1820. Contributor Larry Nagengast dives into this battle in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss the controversy and where things stand right now. So let's start with a little bit of history here. What is the Brown House that we're talking about in Wilmington, and why is it significant?
Well, the Brown House, or to be more precise, one of the early owners of the Brown House, is the reason that Wilmington's Browntown community got its name. Dr. John A. Brown, a Massachusetts native who opened up infirmaries in New England before coming to Wilmington in the 1840s, and who also touted all sorts of medicinal tonics, including something that was called the 1776 root beer, was one of the most flamboyant of the numerous owners of this mansion. It sits on a hill, at the top of a hill on 7th Avenue, just off Maryland Avenue in southwest Wilmington. Now, the previous owners of the house included a gentleman named Jeremiah Woolston, who was a banker and an industrialist and an early 19th century advocate of abolishing slavery. And after Woolston came Navy Captain John Gallagher, who had participated in several prominent battles during the War of 1812. Now, Captain Gallagher gave the house another name, the Anchorage, in recognition of his own military service, and that name is still used on occasion to refer to the house. Now, Dr. Brown also built another important structure in Browntown, a large home that was called the Living Home, which had a capacity of about 50 people or so, and in this home, during the Civil War, he cared for Union soldiers who had been injured in battle, as well as for poor, sick, and insane Wilmington residents. That house was later torn down. But there's a lot of documented history here that relates to Dr. Brown and to the Brown House.
Now, that history could disappear if a private developer gets its hands on the property. What is the current plan for redevelopment of this property?
Well, in fairness, the current plan isn't really that detailed of a plan right now. It's simply this. The city of Wilmington claims that it has not been able to find a good use for this mansion, which has been vacant for 10 to 20 years and has been owned by this Wilmington Housing Partnership for about 6 years. Anyhow, the city claims it hasn't been able to find a good use for the mansion, so it would like to have it torn down, and that way a developer would be able to build townhouses on the site. Now, one developer has expressed interest in building 40 townhouses there, but you couldn't put up that many units and still be able to save the mansion. And whether the mansion stays or goes, City Councilwoman Yolanda McCoy, who represents Browntown, says that the neighborhood, with its narrow streets and limited access off of Maryland Avenue, couldn't handle that many new units anyway.
So even before a developer would get its hands on the property, there is a process it would have to go through. And it doesn't appear that everyone's on the same page in that process. Where are we at, and what are city officials involved saying about this process of deciding what to do?
Well, The debate started last month at a meeting of the Wilmington Design Review and Preservation Commission, which is the city board that has the legal authority to approve demolition requests. Now, the Wilmington Housing Partnership, which actually owns the property, tried to make the case for demolition, but it didn't have all of its paperwork together at, in time for that meeting. So, among other things, it has to document what it has tried to do to sell the property or to find a new use for it, and how much it would cost to restore it to usable condition, and its plans with a timeline for redeveloping the site. Now, because all of that information was not available, the commission tabled the matter. So it's on hold for now, and we're not quite sure what the timing is going to be for the next steps.
You mentioned the fact that the Wilmington Housing Partnership is the one that owns the property right now. And that seems to be clouding this a little bit, because the partnership has had its own issues previously and the city is actively trying to wind it down. And your piece seems to indicate that it hasn't done much to maintain the property and is perhaps failing in its part of the process to resolving what to do with it. Is it fair to say that the partnership is dropping the ball here? And quite frankly, what kind of condition is the property in?
Well, the city isn't going to say that the partnership is dropping the ball. Rather, the city, as you indicated, looks at the partnership as an insolvent organization that, on paper at least, owns a lot of real estate, vacant lots and deteriorating homes. When the partnership fell apart, the city's Department of Real Estate and Housing essentially took it over, and it's trying to sell off that real estate, hoping to recover some of the partnership's losses while opening the path to redevelopment. Now, it is true that little has been done to maintain the property, which the partnership has owned for 6 years. Pretty much all that it's done has been to board up the windows and the doors. Now, Councilwoman McCoy was on the verge of getting the city to put a new roof on the mansion a year or so ago, but a final decision on approving the money for the roof got postponed when the partnership started to come up with this latest round of redevelopment plans early last year.
So you mentioned in your piece that the residents are fighting this. What would they like to see happen? Do they have a plan?
Well, I'd say there are no plans yet, but there's an awful lot of discussion going on. The residents in Browntown, according to Councilwoman McCoy, kind of fall into two camps. The older residents in the community, the ones who know the mansion's history, you know a bit about Miss Mansion's history anyway, they would like to see it preserved and converted into some sort of community use. Now, the newer residents in the area tend to think that the mansion is a bit of an eyesore, and you know that's kind of what it's looked like for the last 10 years or so. And quite frankly, they're tired of looking at it the way it looks now. So these newer residents don't necessarily want it torn down, but if it does stay, they certainly want to see it fixed up.
So part of the equation is the viability of the Brown House. At this juncture, from what we know, how realistic is it to restore the Brown House and make it usable in some way, shape, or form?
That depends upon who you talk to. Now, Bob Weir, who's the head of the partnership and also of the city's real estate department, told the Preservation Commission last month that restoration of the structure would cost about $1 million. Now, preservationists that I've spoken to say that it's a common tactic for the pro-development community to secure inflated estimates of rehabilitation costs for historic properties so that they've got an argument along the lines of, hey, this is too expensive to fix up, so therefore it ought to be torn down. Now, I did talk to Jane Katznelson. She is the woman who restored the Woodstock Mansion in Danning Park, which is about a mile and a half outside of the city, as part of Newcastle County's resident curatorship program. Now, when she started restoring Woodstock, she said that there had been some estimates that it would cost about $1.5 million to do the work. And she says that she got it done for far less than that. Now, Jane Katznelson has also been inside the Brown House, and she's looked around. She thinks that the building is structurally sound, and she points out that it hasn't been subject to much vandalism, if any. She believes that this $1 million estimate that the city has come up with is inflated, and she says that she could probably get the work done for $200,000 or so. So, you know, you've got a question here of, well, what's it going to cost? And that's going to depend upon who does the work and the approaches that they take.
Is there a middle ground here that could kind of split the difference, that brings redevelopment but preserves the brown house in some form and addresses some of the concerns you've mentioned that the residents have about the planned townhouses that would go up?
Well, yes. I would say that there is a middle ground. But I can't say for sure what that middle ground might be. Now, the preservation advocates that I've talked to, Jane Katz Nelson, Mike McGrath from Preservation Delaware, and Michael Emmons from the University of Delaware Center for Historic Architecture and Design, they've all got a lot of ideas. They suggest, well, you know, it could be a community meeting place. It could be a home for nonprofit organizations, or it could be refitted into a couple of apartments. We've talked about a couple of comparable situations in Newcastle County, the Weldon House on Philadelphia Pike, the Darley House up in Claymont, the Jester Art Space up on Grub Road, where there have been plans and various methods taken to redevelop and repurpose these historic structures. So there are plenty of possibilities here. None of the uses that are being suggested as possibilities right now for the Brown House would prevent a developer from putting up some new townhouses in the area, but keeping the mansion would limit the total number of townhouses that could be built. And if you limit the number of townhouses, that, again, might lower the number of developers who are interested in doing the work.
So where do we go from here? Is there any sense of what the timetable looks like for this whole thing being resolved? It feels like it's really in limbo right now.
Limbo is a good place to say that it is, and that's probably a good thing. I mean, you know, while the housing partnership and the city would like to get this property into private hands ASAP, Councilwoman McCoy would rather slow walk the process, making sure that all the options are considered and not having anyone make hasty decisions. Preservationists say that there can be win-win situations. Using an historic structure as the centerpiece of redevelopment reinforces a community's heritage while making it more attractive to newcomers. While this could turn into yet another example of demolition by neglect, a familiar phrase that I've so far avoided using today, a diligent exploration of all the options that are available here, and that's something that hasn't happened yet, just might result in an outcome that satisfies the city, satisfies the community, and satisfies the preservation advocates as well.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece on the battle over the Brown House in Wilmington is available at DelawarePublic.org. And we close out the green next with Arts Playlist, where we learn about a unique film collection being added at Hagley Museum. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. One of the most comprehensive industrial film company collections now lives in Delaware. It's the largest ever motion picture acquisition by the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington and includes films not held by any other library or archive. In this week's Arts Playlist, Hagley curator Kevin Martin joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss the Cinecraft Productions collection.
It's a very large industrial film collection from a company from Cleveland, Ohio. They were founded in 1939, believe it or not, still alive and kicking in Cleveland. What we acquired from them was the film portion of their collection. So this is about 6,000 cans of 16-millimeter film, probably contains about 1,500 unique shows and programs that they did. So the films cover a period from the roughly the 1940s into the 1970s. They range from, you know, 30-minute to hour-long programs or shows that were shown to for training, things of that nature. Also, of course, advertising. They also were involved with very early TV commercials. So we have television commercials from 1949. And in addition to the films, we also have a large collection of films of scripts. So scripts that they used for productions of films and TV commercials. So, you know, we think it's one of the largest intact film collections from an industrial film producer from the era. A lot of these companies went out of business in the 1970s. When they went out of business in the 70s, essentially their films were either tossed or spread to the wind. But luckily, because Cinecraft is still in business, and they have a very large building on Franklin Boulevard in Cleveland, they were able to hang on to these films, and Hagley was lucky enough to make a connection with a man by the name of Jim Cully, whose father founded the company in 1939. And Jim knew Hagley because he worked at DuPont and was from Delaware, and it's just one of those moments of serendipity where we got very lucky and we're thrilled to have the collection.
I'm probably dating myself here. I've probably seen some of these commercials that you mentioned from way back, you know, 100 and some years ago. No, I'm just kidding there. Mm-hmm. How did you guys get so lucky to acquire this major industrial film collection?
Well, the thing is that Hagley, in the last, I would say, 5 years, has really started to think about how we can build out or even build more awareness around our motion picture collection, and this being film and video. So, you know, we've built up an infrastructure where we can digitize a lot of film and video, so we're able to put it online. And, you know, there's a real challenge with motion pictures is because, you know, it's on a medium that isn't very easy to view. It's not like a photograph where you can just plop it in front of someone and they can see it. So we really felt like the best way for us to share our collection was to really get serious about digitization. And we have, you know, a couple of thousand films and videos on our website right now. So because of that, you know, it was just one of those lucky moments where, you know, we had been thinking in our mind, you know, we have the capacity, we have a cold storage facility, which is essentially a giant meat locker where we keep our films. And that's really the ideal preservation space for film. And then we also, as I said, we have a means to digitization. So when we made this connection with Cinecraft, you know, we were able to really sell ourselves as the best place for it. I mean, as you might know, Hagley is, you know, internationally known as the place to study the history of business and technology. Unfortunately, we're not as well known as we would like. So one of the things we had to do with the current owners of Cinecraft is to talk up Hagley. And once they sort of understood where we were, the fact that we have this long history, you know, that we're really committed to, you know, preserving film and video and the motion picture, and motion pictures related to, you know, the history of business, whether it be commercials or industrial films or training films. That was really a great selling point for us. So that is how, you know, it's very common for donors to find us or potential donors to find us. And, you know, it's very rare that we go out seeking collections. Collections usually kind of come to us. And a lot of it, like I said, it's just serendipity. And this was one that just, you know, things just kind of fell in place for it. And it, again, I mean, we first met Cinecraft in about 2017. And it took us about 2 years to get to the point where they were comfortable enough to commit to donating the collection to Hagley, and arrived in 2019, and we're just getting our heads around it. And this is why we're announcing it now, because we finally have, you know, something to show people. you know, we were able to link out to, I believe we have a couple of, maybe about 200 films online at this point, and, you know, a lot more scripts. And a good number of still photographs, too, all can be found at hagley.org/Citicraft.
This is all such fantabulous news. Just want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Kevin Martin. Kevin is the curator at the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington. And we're talking about the fact that the Hagley Museum has acquired a major industrial film collection from the Cinecraft Productions. You know, you mentioned that the collection includes films watched in classrooms, auditoriums, churches, company and neighborhood theaters, corporate events, board meetings, luncheon clubs, union halls. Talk about celebrities who appeared in Cinecraft Productions. They include a lot of names that I recognize.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So one of the things that's really interesting about the collection is that there are a number of well-known celebrities that appeared in films, people like Alan Alda and Merv Griffin, and Chet Hundley did some voiceover work for them. So they, you know, even today, you know, a way for an actor to make some extra money, of course, is to appear in commercials and industrial films and training films. And, you know, obviously it was the same way back then. The thing with Cinecraft is that the Cleveland Playhouse in Cleveland would attract a lot of actors. You know, and that was one way that they were able to get, you know, some of these folks to appear in film. Another well-known name, well, he's actually more of a well-known face than a well-known name, and that's Joey Brown, who appeared in a film. And he's one of those guys that if you watch Turner Classic Movies, he's a very, very memorable face, Joey Brown. But in addition to, you know, when people pass through, you know, trying to get them to appear in these industrials, there was also an executive producer for Cinecraft who actually went out to Hollywood and would recruit as well. So they were able to bring some people in, and a lot of them were not necessarily established when they first appeared. So, for example, there's a film called Milestones of Motoring that was done for Standard Oil of Ohio, and that included Joey Brown and Merv Griffin. And this is, they claim, or one of the executive producer of the film, Bob Havlund, claims it's one of the first appearances that Merv Griffin made in a film. That prior to that, he was doing a lot of vaudeville and stage work, but this is one of the first times that he appeared in a film. So there is a lot of well-known names at the time. I mean, a lot of the names I think have since been have since been forgotten. But you know, it was a way for, you know, obviously to get a named actor. You know, it was just a way to garner interest. And in Cinecraft's case, if the client was willing to pay for it, they were happy to find someone whose face would or whose name and face would be known.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, Kevin, last year, 2020, was a bad year for many arts institutions because of the COVID pandemic. We're starting to come out on the other side of that now. Lots and lots more people are getting vaccinated each and every day, which is helping with that. This must feel good after the bad news of last year. This must feel great to you and your team at Hagley to announce this, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's one of those things that we have been able to work on it to a certain extent during the pandemic. We probably would have announced it much sooner. But like I said, the collection came in at in late 2019. And, you know, we've had stretches here at Hagley where we've been working remotely, also working staggered schedules to keep the social distance. And we do have a film and video digitization person. So our film and video and digitization person, Ona Coughlin, she's been able to come in a couple days a week and keep the wheels of progress in motion here. So she's still been digitizing films. Last summer, we were able to have an intern here who did a great job with digitizing a lot of the scripts. So it is great for us to finally announce it. I mean, and this has been, you know, again, this is a collection that we first made contact with Cinecraft in 2017. So to finally let the world know that it's here, we're so looking forward to seeing how it's used. We're looking forward to seeing how scholars use it. Hopefully we can find people who want to license it for, you know, documentaries. I mean, it's just such a wonderful collection, and you know, it's going to be here long after I'm gone. So I'm just, it's one of those things that's a real feather, you know, in Hagley's cap. It's a really big feather in my cap professionally to get a collection like this here at Hagley.
Thanks to Hagley curator Kevin Martin and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. And thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.